This is an interview with Horst Luke on, on the 17th of October 2006 at Semaphore for the University of Adelaide Oral History Project. Interviewer Rob Lynn. This is the first session of the recording. Horst, thank you very much for agreeing to be interviewed. Could you just tell me a little about your personal background, please, in Germany? You were born in 1929.
Yes, I was born in 1929 in a place called Ronsdorf, which is a town of about 15,000 people. About 6 months after I was born, the town lost its independence and was incorporated into a greater metropolis, which was called Wuppertal. I spent the first 13 years of my life growing up there, like any kind of normal child, I dare say. The war, of course, intervened in 1939, and 4 years later, my childhood came to an end, because the town experienced an air raid, and our house, together with most of the inner part of this town of Ronsdorf, was obliterated, burned down. I thought that was a very strange occurrence. And life somehow seemed to be rather different afterwards. Mm. It was more, the adult world was more intruding into my childlike existence. And I realized that there were dimensions to life which had nothing much to do with playing in the gardens and so on. Mm. So I think that I regard that as, in a sense, I think, as I said, the end of childhood.
Horst, what was your father's occupation?
My father was a businessman. He was a representative of a steel company and also later worked a good deal of insurance. He established an insurance agency and became, as it were, involved in the insurance business.
Now, what about your education path? Did that begin in your village?
Well, I think Ronsdorf had a number of primary schools, and I attended one that was fairly close to where we lived. That's where I received my first religious and other education. The teachers thought that it would be helpful to the education of youngsters, particularly in arithmetic, if they promoted this with a stick. If I wasn't able to say fairly quickly how much is 16 by 17, I would get one. Arithmetic's always been a fairly weak aspect of my ability, I think, probably as a result of this type of treatment. When I was 10, I left this primary school and went to high school, which is the usual thing. Only about 10% or 15% of the school population would take this step. The others would continue at primary school. And there was a small branch of a larger secondary school in Ronsdorf, and I attended that. It was a delightful period, because we had boys and girls in the school, which was very unusual. Once these 3 years were up, I had to go to the main branch in the center of the city, and that was boys only. After we lost the house, my father was in the army, and my mother decided that we had to move to central Germany, and I then spent the rest of the war in a place called Lammspringe, which is a town of about 3,000 people. Not far from Hildesheim, and I used to go to school in Hildesheim. Mm. And this is where my schooling, my war schooling at any rate, ended in 1945. Of course, the schools ceased to operate. And I went back to Wuppertal with my parents. And my father came back from the war, from the British POW camp. Mm. And I resumed schooling in Wuppertal, in the same school which I'd gone before, and did my final exams in 1949. And thereafter, I went to Cologne University, where I studied law until 1953.
Did your father change? Was your father changed by those war years, do you think, Horst?
My father was. He was a Well, there were streaks of irresponsibility in his conduct. He gambled too much.
Mm.
And this caused a good many difficulties in our personal lives. My mother and I had to bear the consequences of this to some extent. So, but I wouldn't, I don't know whether this had anything to do with the war. It caused a certain amount of unhappiness in our personal relations.
Now, for you, was Cologne University a very good experience?
The faculty, the law faculty at Cologne University was a very, very good one. They had a good many extremely capable and well-known professors. One example is Professor Nipperdey, for instance, who taught private law.
So what was his name, Horst?
Nipperdey. Nipperdey was his name. He eventually became the president of the Federal Appeal Court in labor matters. Germany has a number of branches of the judiciary, and this was one. So, and his works are well remembered even now. So, it's just one example of a number of very, very good people who were there. So I think the experience was a very positive one on the whole. Mm. Although I did find that the best part of the educational experience was really the writing of essays, which I thought was a very positive thing. And I wrote a lot of those, even though it wasn't necessarily compulsory.
Mm.
And I think I gained more from that than almost anything else, certainly more than I did from the lectures.
Now, had you been involved in the international work camp situation before or after university?
No, this is beforehand. I wasn't able to go to attend university immediately after graduating from school. There was about an intermission of about half a year, and I thought I'd make use of that by joining international student work camps. They've been set up by the Quakers and by similar organizations in the course of rebuilding Europe. I attended a number of these camps and found those very, very positive, largely because I was able to meet people, students, and others from so many other countries. We had people from New Zealand, United States, England, Indonesia, did I mention Indonesia, Holland, and so on, and from everywhere they came. And after having been, shall we say, somewhat claustrophobically confined in a totally German context, I found this really quite a liberating experience. The relations in these camps tended to be very good and friendly, and it was all based on the idea of doing pick and shovel work, as it were. It was a very simple form of existence. And because of the international aspect of it, I found it very, very positive indeed, and maintained contact with quite a few of the people I met there for many years.
So for you, that was a liberating experience.
It was, yes. Yes. I think that, life in Germany was pretty one-dimensional because of the very repressive political situation in which we found ourselves. The only thing that was available was Nazi ideology that penetrated certain aspects of school, not all aspects of school, but it did penetrate into German teaching, it penetrated into biology particularly. And so, you tended to get this kind of belligerent, chauvinistic aspect rammed down your throat.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it was a form of liberation, really, from that sort of myopic view of life.
Horst, you told me when we last met of this story of carting 1,500 weight of potatoes across Germany. Was that at this time also?
Yes, it was. It was when we transferred back to Wuppertal from central Germany. The distance was about 400 kilometers, and of course, from 1945 until 1947. The poor old Germans were giving some of their own medicine, so to speak, the medicine they dished out to the countries surrounding Germany when they were occupying them, was that the Germans were not going to go hungry, even if the other people did, And all of a sudden the situation was reversed. It was the Germans who were going hungry, which was quite a wholesome experience in some ways. But one had to tend to look after oneself a little. Living in a very rural sort of context, we had access to certain things like potatoes, and we knew that this was a very rare article in Western Germany. So when we transferred our possessions to West Germany, there were also quite a few potatoes that I was given the task of transferring them to Wuppertal, where there was great potato famine, you see. And it was all done on a tractor with a number of trailers. The potatoes were in boxes which we'd been able to get, which had originally been very solid boxes, which had originally been designed and manufactured in order to carry landmines.
An extraordinary story. And
the maximum speed of this conveyance was 15 kilometers per hour. So that's, on the Autobahn, you're no longer allowed to take anything that can't go any faster, you see. But then we did, and it took days before we actually got to our destination.
What took you into the choice of law as a major at university?
Well, I think we were very strongly, when I was at school, we were very strongly under the influence of a very impressive teacher of religion. He was a Lutheran pastor who'd been a member of the Confessing Church and an ardent enemy of the Nazi movement. And he'd been saved from ending up in a concentration camp only by being drafted into the army. And he'd gone through the Russian campaign, came back in 45, and he was a most impressive. I mean, everyone in our class, all the boys in our class were very impressed by him. And it was obvious that my destination was theology. So that's what it says on my matriculation certificate. But once his influence waned, I think this determination became fainter and fainter. And one reason why I studied law is because I was a bit uncertain as to what to do after religion gave way, as it were. And I sent my handwriting to a graphology expert, and the advice was to study law. Now, I'm not sure that was really the motivating factor, but it sort of reinforced the idea that this is what I should do.
So, following your time at Cologne, you were in fact fortunate to gain a Fulbright scholarship?
No, it wasn't quite at that time. I think I graduated in 53 and then became a referendar, which is a sort of trainee in law. This was a 3.5-year period during which we were taken through all the practical aspects of the administration of the law. So civil, criminal, administrative and so on. And it was after I'd been in this program in Wuppertal for about 1.5 years that a circular came around inviting people to apply for a Fulbright scholarship, together with the advice that there wasn't much point in trying because people didn't seem to be successful in gaining this. But anyway, I wasn't deterred by this, applied, and was eventually lucky enough to be given one of these scholarships. I think the Americans were fairly liberal in distributing these scholarships in Germany because they had this sort of sense that the German youngsters need to be re-educated. So I was a bit of a beneficiary of that policy.
Was the time at New York University an enjoyable time for
you? Oh, very much, yes. I enjoyed that enormously. I thought that it was, in a sense, I think it was rather different from the Cologne experience because the Americans have a sort of tendency to work so much harder. You know, the students are just incredibly industrious to the point where we thought they were limiting themselves a little bit, you know, doing nothing else other than study law. Anyway, it was difficult to avoid that kind of. I got into this. That was the ethos of New York University Law School, and you can't escape these things altogether. So I worked incredibly hard, particularly in my second year. I was there for only 1 year. The program was only for 1 year, but because I came top in our class, they decided to invite me to become a teaching fellow in the second year. And during that period, I was to do something else as well. So I studied in the ordinary LLB program. And it was then that I became an American student, as it were, working just as hard as I did. I mean, I remember before the constitutional law examination at the end of that second year, for example, I spent one whole night unable to go to sleep because I was so full of constitutional law.
Does it always affect people like this?
No, I think I might have been a little more susceptible than some to this kind of thing. But anyway, I did very well as a result. And at the end of the second year, the dean suggested I might want to go to, I think it was Indianapolis in Indiana, as a sort of as a visiting professor for a year. But I was keen to get back to Germany, finish my German program, my German practical studies. And so I didn't do this.
Had the American experience opened you up to a wider view of life, do you think?
Well, I think it was really reinforcing the experiences I had in these work camps, in a sense, because, again, it was a very international. New York, people said New York is very different from the rest of America, because it was at that time. Anyway, it's a very international, you know. It was reinforcing these early experiences in a more intellectual sphere, so to speak. I think that is probably what happened. Yes, it did. And of course, the law school was. It had international programs, and it had programs bringing in the best from all over America, the country. So I got to know quite a few very bright American students, and have remained friends with them until this day. We had a phone call only just a little while ago from a friend of mine who lives in Philadelphia, who wants to come and visit us. It's all very nice.
Now, you met your wife in America too, is
yes.
that correct?
Yes, indeed, yes. It was a strange story. We met at a dinner organized by Dr. Pratt, who was an American psychiatrist with a special interest in foreign students. I hope the interest was not professional. It was more sort of personal. And there was a party for about 70 or so foreign students, which I attended, a dinner party. And they had a lecturer. He invited a lecturer from one of the American colleges to talk about Indian folk music. And the lady came with a zither, an Indian zither, a zither-like instrument. And during a break, I saw this sitting there, and Ruth was standing close to it as well. And I liked what I saw, I must admit. She was fairly simply dressed, but elegantly. And she wasn't wearing a great deal of makeup. And the conclusion I drew that she must be a German girl. So it was on this basis that I made some sort of inane comment about this is that to her. See. And from this developed a bit of a conversation. And then we met again. Over a period of about a year or so, interrupted by a period I spent in Germany, we corresponded and eventually became engaged.
Now, Ruth, an Australian girl, was in America.
She was in, she was born in Brisbane, and she had been in Sydney studying. She was a pianist, really, but she'd also studied librarianship in Sydney. I worked as a librarian in Reigate in England for 2 years, and then went to America on a kind of exchange program. So she was working in the Brooklyn Public Library when I met her, and eventually became a member of staff of the Columbia Library School. And it's at that point that we became engaged, very much against the advice of the Professor Lindemann, that she worked with at the time, who thought that marrying a German was the most fearful mistake she could possibly make. Because German husbands, he thought, Professor Lindemann thought, were the most dreadful husbands on earth, you see. Well, she just didn't know how meek I was.
Horst, with that background, you with German studying in America, and Ruth and a Queenslander studying in America, how did you ever come to the University of Adelaide in 1959?
Well, I think our plan was to... I returned to Germany in 57, in July of 1957, and resumed my work as a referendar, working with the courts, with various courts. And the plan was, we had ideas that of sort of remaining, completing my training there, and Ruth completing a PhD in New York, and then marrying after about 2 years. But as the point of separation approached, this became a more and more unrealistic kind of prospect, because we weren't so very young anymore. We were both sort of 30. And we realized that a period of 2 years, separation of 2 years, might be too much of a strain on the relationship for it to survive. And so we decided very boldly and very stupidly in a way, because we didn't have the financial basis for marriage. So she would come to Germany, we'd get married straight away. This is what actually happened. Anyway, we spent 1.5 years in Germany. I completed my doctoral degree at Cologne University, and I also completed my assessor exam, as that is called in Germany, which enabled me to practice in Germany. As these events approached, Ruth became more and more nervous about our prospects afterwards. And she also wasn't terribly happy living in Germany, so she encouraged me to seek career avenues elsewhere. I wrote to America, to Dean Niles, who was the dean of the law school, and I also wrote to Jeffrey Saw in Australia, who was then the head of the Department of Legal Studies at the ANU. And Saw sent a copy of my letter to the various law schools, and it was Adelaide that responded very positively. They suggested that if I wanted to come, they would encourage me to do so, because the universities, including the law schools, were undergoing a period of expansion. Although they couldn't appoint me to a lectureship or anything of that sort, they could appoint me to a tutorship for 1 year, mm-hmm. With the possibility of reappointment if it became mutually satisfactory. And it was on this kind of basis that I packed up or left behind all my German involvements and eventually arrived here in Adelaide on the 29th of July, 1959.
Of course, you told me when we last spoke that you actually also approached the law societies in Australia.
Yes. I wrote to law societies as well. And the replies which I received, I think they were all courteous enough to reply. But I can only describe the replies I received as frosty. I think they must have thought it rather odd for someone with a German background to want to join the Australian legal profession. And that wasn't terribly encouraging, I must admit.
So on the 29th of July 1959, you arrive in Adelaide. What was the University of Adelaide like at the time, Horst?
I was sort of introduced into the law department, and I was given to understand that the law department had expanded fairly recently. This was the result of the appointment of Professor Norman Morris, who had been appointed, I think, in 1958. And he had succeeded in inducing the university to establish a number of new lecturing positions. And he brought with him a group of people who were affectionately described by people in Adelaide as the Melbourne Mafia. One of them was Alex Castles, who was destined to become one of the law professors in Adelaide in 1967, until his retirement, was one of the very highly regarded law teachers and researchers here in Adelaide. And he's really, in a sense, he became the father, if you like, of the discipline of Australian legal history, with his writings and so on. Another one is Igor Kavass, son of a Latvian father and a Ukrainian mother, and having, according to Professor O'Connell, inherited the weakness of Russian melancholia.
Was his surname spelt K-V-A-S-S?
Igor.
Yeah, surname?
Oh, surname, Kavass. K-A-V-A-S-S, yes, Kavass, Igor Kavass. Igor wasn't terribly happy in Adelaide. He spent on study leave to Alabama in America and rather liked the American scene, and eventually transferred entirely to America and became really the most important legal law librarian in the United States. I've met him again a number of times, and there's no doubt that he was a very big man in the United States, in American terms, indeed, also in the international librarian field and so on. Frank Maher was another one, was close to Santa Maria, close for the was it the civic movement, is that what they called it?
Yes, that's part of it.
Yes, he was politically very close to him, an elderly man. He was renowned as the most successful first-year teacher in the country. Wasn't too happy in Adelaide and went back to Melbourne after a time. So it was this sort of group that I was in. Someone whom Morris had inherited, as it were, was Dan O'Connell. He was the international law teacher in Adelaide. A person who had been, he had a Cambridge PhD. Became more and more respected in the international law field and was enormously productive. His book on state succession, that's his PhD thesis, was eventually turned into a two-volume book, probably the most important work in the field of state succession, which is one of the aspects, important aspects of international law. He also wrote a treatise on international law in two volumes, a book on Richelieu and so on. So he's enormously successful and had been, in a sense, I think, the person who'd taken the greatest interest in me, perhaps because of the fact that his wife was German. He told me in early letters that my matrimonial situation was the reverse of his. So. But I think when you ask what the university was like, well, I think the law school at the time was obviously an expanding institution. Morris was a man of such enormous management skills and with such good sense that he integrated the law school into the overall legal system in South Australia. He established continuing legal education for lawyers. He also integrated us into the wider academic world. He was the sort of man who didn't feel in the least inferior to people in the highest possible places, whether it was Harvard or Oxford. He would always converse and correspond with people in these places on terms of total equality. And as a result, I think we had a period considerable international integration with visitors from other places coming to Adelaide and so on. So I thought it was I was very interested in the common law, which seemed to me to be so much more interesting than German law, which is all codified in statutory form, partly because it was just more historically linked with the history of the law than was the case with the civil law systems. So I was very happy with that transfer.
What about physically coursed? Where was it situated when you arrived?
Well, I think the law school was on the first floor of the Mitchell Building. And it was a very elegant environment. As you know, the Mitchell Building is a wonderful building. It was a little bit on the small side. They didn't have a room for me, for example. I was given a desk up in the attic, which is a very large area. And when I came to work one day, it turned out that somebody had removed everything there was in the attic. They decided to clean it out, and they cleaned out not only all the rubbish that was sitting up there, but also my desk. So I had a good deal of difficulty to recover my possessions. So I was pretty upset about that. But I also taught up there. In the attic, there was a special sort of table where I held my tutorials.
I can't picture the attic, so you just keep climbing the stairway.
I think there must be, yes. I can't quite remember how I got up there, but there must have been a separate staircase leading all the way up there. That's where I was for quite a period. But then, of course, after a number of months, we were transferred to a newly built annex of the Barsmith Library, which was very unattractive accommodation. But the law library was downstairs, and the studies were on the first floor.
Is this the Western Annex, Horst? Nearest to the Union?
It is, yes, the Western Annex. Yes, it was built at that time. And philosophy and French were accommodated there as well. Mm. But it was all rather tight. The accommodation was pretty tight, and they didn't have a study for me. So I had to be content to be accommodated in the philosophy department, one story higher up, you see, which suited me perfectly because I thought the philosophers were delightful people. Jack Smart and Charlie Martin and Presley and all these people, I got to know very well. I used to have tea with them, and I thought that was the most enriching experience. a bit like my work camp experience. You get to know people who are not lawyers. I was not unhappy there at all, but I think some people, O'Connell particularly, accused the registrar of being an empire builder and kicking us out of this marvellous accommodation in the Mitchell building with its lovely bookshelves and furniture and so on.
Was the registrar Vic Edgelow at the time?
That was Vic Edgelow at the time, yes.
How did he strike you, Hoth?
Well, Vic had a view of academics which wasn't necessarily endearing to academics. He took the view that all academics were fraudulent until they'd established their honesty. And I had a bit of a problem with that myself when I became head of the department. But I think I persuaded him in the end that he could believe me. Another point he made was that when you set an academic a deadline, well, that will be the day on which he will start working on the matter he's supposed to do. So he was fairly cynical, but I think Vic also had a tendency to, I'm not sure how good he was at delegating. I think Dan O'Connell came one day and said that the registrar had taken over the parking arrangements. He was directing the traffic in the car park. So Vic, I think, I rather liked Vic. I think he had a great love of the university. To him, the university was the one and only thing. He'd grown up from the ranks. I think that he once described the university as an organic mystery, I think, or a mysterious organism or something of this kind. But he was very much a man of the old school, don't drink your beer until you're 25. And he'd given all these undertakings and kept to them. I think he was considered, when I came, that was in the days of Henry Baston, who was Vice Chancellor. Mm. He was considered the dominant person in the university, and people tended to think that the Vice Chancellor was in his pocket, you see. And I remember a meeting of the Staff Association at which Baston had to introduce himself. And you had to not only state your name and status, but also the department in which you worked, you see. So he introduced himself as Vice Chancellor working in the Registrar's Department. As you can imagine, Percy was regarded as most amusing because people had this sort of notion of him. Whether that was justified, I don't know. I thought Bestman was a very good Vice Chancellor.
Where was the Staff Association in those days?
Well, I think they tended to meet in the old anatomy building, which had been converted to the staff club. That's where the meetings took place. Mm. We also had a meeting in the old Prince of Wales building at one stage, in one of the lecture theatres there, I remember. That was quite a memorable meeting because Hugh Stratton was trying very hard to get an Israeli to join his staff, and the Israeli wasn't given a visa by the Australian government on the basis that he'd been a member of the Stern Gang, you see. And Stratton argued that because he'd been personally involved in history in this way, he was going to be a particularly competent lecturer. But I don't think he got him. I've no idea who he was. I can't recall his name. But just that's one of the things that I remember from the Staff Association, early Staff Association days.
You recalled Hugh Stratton then. Mm. Were there other people like Hugh on the wider university that you found interesting characters?
Well, there were. I mean, people like Badger and so on. But I didn't really get to know the wider university nearly as intimately as I did later when I became head of the law department in 1970. All of a sudden, I was confronted with senior committees, the allocations committee and so on. And so I became fairly familiar. That was, in some ways, it was my first opportunity to really become thoroughly acquainted with people from all over the university, leading lights from all over the university, and that was a most positive experience, I must say.
Before we get to that period, yes. Horst, could we just backtrack a little?
Yes.
What was Adelaide like for you and your family in the early 1960s? Did you feel accepted?
Well, being with my particular background, a German background, and if you like, Nazi background, my expectation was that I would have difficulties in the Anglo-Saxon world. At New York University Law School, I had been put in an institution which could be almost described as a Zionist law school, because the 90% of the student body would have been Jewish, you see. Never did I have a single instance. I cannot recall a single instance where I would have been exposed to any kind of criticism or rejection on the basis of my being German. And much the same applied in Adelaide. I cannot recall a single instance in Adelaide of having been sort of viewed critically on that basis, which doesn't mean that I wasn't so viewed. I mean, that is entirely possible, but it was certainly never communicated to me, which in retrospect, I must say, is a very happy state of affairs. You know, I think that I think people were inclined to view you just on a personal basis, rather than on the basis of your belonging to any kind of group or nationality. Well, I remember when the university wanted me to become the head of the law department, I went to the vice chancellor and said, "Look, this is impossible because I'm still German." And Badger immediately went to his shelves and pulled down the University Act and said, "Look, it says here that we cannot discriminate on the basis of religion, nationality, or whatever." You see. So that was very quickly wiped off the table, in particular. I thought I might escape the fate worse than death in this way.
Did you have much of a university social life in those early years you were here?
Well, Ruth joined the university women's club, university wives club it was called in the early days, and so she became, she was well integrated into the university on that kind of basis. They had their meetings where they greeted new members of staff and so on. I think that my own involvement with the university as a whole, I think, was rather, I was very busy as a young lecturer. Mm-hmm. You know, that was my, it was really more or less a law environment in which I was moving rather than, but of course a law environment didn't mean only academics, you know. In those days we were all members of the faculty, all the law lecturers were members of the law faculty. And the law faculty had practitioners, judges on it and so on. So we got to know these sorts of people too. And, you know, I mean, I remember, for example, Howard Zelling coming out to us. We were living in Klemzig in a housing trust house for afternoon tea. So there was a certain amount of integration, if you like, into the legal profession on a very limited kind of basis in that sort of way.
So were people like the Zellings very welcoming, were they?
Well, yes, in a limited sort of way.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, the O'Connells were very, very welcoming. As soon as we came, we had a personal relationship with them. They drove us down to Victor Harbour to show us a little of the country and so on. And I think the relations with members of the legal profession were not as lively as that. But we used to meet simply in the law faculty. And occasionally there was a little personal contact, but there wasn't, I wouldn't describe that as intense.
Did you find the law profession reasonably closed or parochial in Adelaide?
I think there were periods of tension between the law faculty and the law school and the legal profession. Some members of the legal profession were extremely critical of what was going on in the law school. And, you know, that's natural. I think you find that in a lot of places. Mm. When I became head of the law department in 1970, I also became more or less automatically a member of the Law Society Council. I was a member of the council for 6 years, and of course got to know people very well at that way. And I don't think I missed a single meeting because I thought it was so important that there should be a link. You know, we might not always have the same point of view, but at least there should be a good deal of communication. This was my point of view.
How did you actually become head of the law school, Horst? You said it was a fate worse than death.
It was in 1964 that Arthur Rogerson arrived. He had been a fellow of Jesus College, Oxford, and he had been appointed to the deanship, to a professorship and the deanship. He became the Bryniathan Professor of Law, and it was understood that the deanship went with it. He was certainly automatically the head of the law department for life, as far as we knew. He wasn't automatically the dean because the dean needed to be elected year by year, but the understanding was that he would more or less automatically be elected. And now once we moved into the Vietnam period, you know, 1968, 69, the position of any kind of permanent head of any kind of department became very controversial. The law school is no exception, and there were a lot of people who felt that the staff should have a good deal more involvement in the affairs of the law school. And there was, if you like, a kind of revolution against the head. You know, no discredit to Arthur, I always got on very well with him. But he was in England at the time, and I think the staff sent a delegation to the Vice-Chancellor, insisting on a change in the governmental arrangements in the law school. Arthur took this rather personally, which is unfortunate. But at any rate, he eventually resigned, and so someone else had to take over. I had tried in this whole affair to take a fairly neutral position, or an independent position. I had objected to the idea of making any moves while he was away. And so I was regarded as a very ideal person to take over, because I was sort of between the two camps, as it were, those who supported Arthur and those who opposed him. I found this whole experience a very unhappy experience, and I certainly didn't like being put in the position of taking over, because it must have given the head of department, Arthur, the impression that I was the manipulator behind the whole business, having done so with the object of moving to his position, which is not how it happened at all. At any rate, when he came back, I think it turned out that he was very understanding. I think he cooperated well with me. There were occasional difficulties, but they were natural, because Arthur was, generally speaking, a somewhat difficult fellow. But at any rate, I think we kept things going. It was a difficult period, the students were. I mean, when I took over, I felt that I was fighting on ever so many fronts. The students were rebellious, the law society was critical, the other faculties didn't like what the law school was doing, so one was surrounded by people who had to be persuaded to be more cooperative, as it were. And I think, feel that I was reasonably successful.
Do you know if that was typical for the university as a whole at that period?
I think there were a lot of rumblings in, yes, many other places as well. I don't know any great detail about this, but we had a difficult time.
Horst, could you just explain your movement through the law school from the years you arrived until this
point? Well, I was a tutor in 1959 and continued in that position in 1960. And because I didn't have an Australian degree, I think I was encouraged to study in the LLB program. I was given credit for quite a good deal of the work I'd done in the United States, because I'd been in the LLB program there, you know, studying subjects like torts and contract and so on. And but I studied something like seven subjects in order to qualify for the LLB, and I did qualify at the end of 1960, having worked very, very hard at that time. And I was then appointed to a senior lectureship. A senior lectureship because there was a general policy that law schools around Australia should recruit at that level. Recruiting at lecturer level was considered to be unsatisfactory because there was so much competition from the legal profession for really good people. So in a way, that was a fairly fortunate beginning, from my point of view. And I was then promoted to reader in 1965, and I was promoted to a personal chair in 1967. At that time, we had O'Connell. There were a number of, I think the faculty consisted of about 25 people or so, and we had O'Connell, one of the professors. Castles had become a professor too in 1967, and there was Rogerson. So it was the total complement of professors was four.
Would you have anticipated when you came in 59 that you would be a professor within a decade?
Of course not. No, I think that my German colleagues, when I went back to Germany and explained the situation, they thought my rise to that level was nothing short of rapid, you see. And when I was told this, it was quite obvious that there was a kind of somewhat critical tone which accompanied the comments that were made.
Was there an understanding in Germany that one should serve an apprenticeship a bit longer, was there?
Well, I mean, the situation in Germany is utterly different. You know, there first of all, you write your doctoral dissertation, and then you write a second doctoral dissertation, which gives you what is called the Dr. Habil. That is the doctor, the sort of research work you do in order to qualify to be allowed to lecture in universities. And for some people, this takes a lot of time, you know, and not infrequently. I think people finally manage to get a chair when they're 45 or 50. Mm. So the situation is very, very different. Mm. This is one reason why they thought that, my friends in Germany thought that it was all happening rather rapidly.
Well, Horst, what had you been teaching throughout the 1960s?
I started with torts and contracts, which were both central common law subjects and are, even to this day, I think they can be regarded as fairly central subjects. I taught, during the first few years I taught, it was common practice at that time for people to teach 2.5 subjects. My main subject was contract. Second subject was private international law, which is, I don't know whether you're familiar with that as a subject.
No.
Private international law is different from international law, in the sense that it's part of the Australian legal system. It isn't an overarching thing that, as it were, regulates the relationships of nations, which is the case with international law. Rather, it's that part of the law of South Australia and the law of Australia, which governs situations which have international links. For example, a marriage concluded overseas would have to be tested here for its validity, and the principles that apply to that are the principles of private international law, or a contract concluded overseas, or a tort committed in one country by people from other countries, and so on. Whenever there's this kind of international involvement, you have a special set of principles which govern the question which particular legal system needs to be applied in Australia in order to resolve the issues that arise in that way.
Mm.
So I taught that until 1967 or thereabouts. And I also became very interested in legal history, and particularly the history of the law of contract. I think that it was my work in legal history. It was 15th century English legal history, which I dealt with, 16th century English legal history that I dealt with. I think in a way that sort of accounted a bit for my success with promotions and so on, because that the people and the legal historians in Oxford rather liked that, and they would have written fairly good references.
Mm. Did you publish in that book?
Pardon me?
Did you publish in that?
Oh yes, it was published. The Law Quarterly Review was good enough to publish a long article of mine on that subject, which is, at the time, it was regarded as a bit of a breakthrough, because, I mean, I remember one English legal historian writing a second edition of his book on contract, saying that his work on 16th century contract development was based entirely on my article. So it was a fairly successful piece of work. But now, of course, eventually they moved on and dealt with things, particularly John Baker from Cambridge moved on and dealt with these sorts of matters on a slightly different footing. I mean, I still don't think that he's right. I think that but I corresponded with him and he referred to my work and so on. So I think that gave me what in Adelaide is regarded as very important, which is a bit of an international reputation. So.
Was there a link philosophically in Adelaide at the time, and I may be getting into uncertain territory here, between the old British universities and Adelaide, was there still seen to be that link between the institutions, do you think?
Well, I think, you see, Arthur had been a fellow of Jesus College, Oxford, when he took over. And even through Norval Morris, we had links with Oxford. In 1962, Rupert Cross, who was a very well-known Oxford academic, a blind man who'd been blind from birth, he spent a whole year in Adelaide teaching evidence, which was his main field. Later, in 1967, we had David Williams here for a whole year, we had David Williams had been a fellow of Keble College in Oxford. We had Derek Davies here frequently, a number of times, also for fairly long periods. He was a fellow of Catherine College in Oxford. So you know, there were fairly close links with Oxford at that time. And of course, eventually, some of our people became members of the faculty in Oxford. Usually, Dan O'Connor was appointed in 72. He was appointed Professor of International Law in Oxford. John Finnis had gone to Oxford in the early 60s and eventually became a professor of jurisprudence in Oxford. So yes, I think these links were fairly significant, and in a way they gave us a bit of additional status which we might not have had before. Oxford links were always very important in the law school because, you know, go back to the days of Dick Blackburn, for example, who was a professor of law from 49 to 57 here. Mm-hmm. He had been he was an Oxford graduate. He was an Adelaide man who'd gone to Oxford to do the BCL and came back with the BCL.
Did you meet him?
And was, oh yes, yes, I took over from him. He taught contract and I took over from him. He continued to teach contract even after his retirement. He retired in 57 and carried on until 58. Mm. And 59, he still taught in 59 and 60, that's right. And I then took over in 61, you see. And I started writing articles in contract. And I remember sending him my first article, which was called Striking a Bargain. And I got a letter back from him saying that he was appalled that anybody should put forward such views. So he didn't like it at all. And I think he must have felt badly having written to me in these rather acid terms, because when I wrote another piece later, when he had become a judge of the ACT Supreme Court, he mentioned this other piece in one of his judgments and gave it the most enthusiastic commendation. So that was all very nice.
The perils of publishing.
Exactly. That's right.
What about some of the other people you taught with through this period, Horst? Could you tell me a little bit about them? You've mentioned Igor Kavas and Alex Castles and Dan O'Connell. Who were some of the others?
Well, in the very early days, when I arrived here, of course, that was pretty well the compliment. Mm. You know, there was Frank Maher, I mentioned him as well. Shortly thereafter, I think it might have been in 61, that Norval Morris appointed Colin Howard. He was an English academic. He'd been a lecturer in Queensland. Queensland actually did have lecturers. You know, he was appointed at lecturer level, so it wasn't all the universities, of course, but senior lecturer level. We had another English academic who came over was Brian Hogan. He came from Leeds. He was a member of staff in Leeds. And he maintained that he was suffering from lawyer's impotence, as he called it. he couldn't have children. And he and his wife Pauline, he said, couldn't have children because of this. He maintained it was the result of sitting at your desk for too long. So it was caused impotence. Anyway, it couldn't have been too bad because there was a period of about 6 months during which just about every member of staff was able to announce the birth of a girl, you see, including the Hogans.
Including the Hogans.
That's right. So he must have been cured by the air of Adelaide, I think, his condition. So, I mean, relations at that very early time were very close. We had lots of parties and we saw a lot of each other. You know, this, the legal academics represented a relatively close-knit group in a way. Inviting people to dinner, having parties and so on, regarded as a natural part of life. You know. And Colin Howard didn't really fit all that well into that sort of environment. He was a fairly acerbic kind of character, very able, enormously able man. I think heaved a sigh of relief when he was recruited by Zerman Carr into the Melbourne Law School. He became a professor at the Melbourne Law School.
Mm. What about people in the wider profession like John Bray? Did you have much to do with him?
Oh, yes. Well, John Bray, of course, was very keen on the law school. You know, he was really an academic at heart, if you like.
Yeah.
And whenever we had a staff seminar, he would come down and take part. You know, he would sit there and listen to what people had to say. I remember giving a paper on specific on the enforcement of money claims, and John Bray was right there listening and so on. He liked my approach because he was very interested in legal history, very interested in Roman law, and to him, I think I sort of combined things which are relatively rare in law schools. One, the interest in legal history, and secondly, the sort of link with Roman law, you see, and I read both those things. So I think I can honestly say that I was never very close to him personally, but in academic terms, he rather liked what I was doing, I think.
At an early staff dinner, did you have a rejoinder with him, was that correct? You mentioned something about the German sense of humour and he had to give a reply, was that right?
Trying to remember. Oh, of course. Oh, this was very early. This was way back in 1961 when I had only just been appointed. I went to a student dinner, and because I was the most junior member of staff, I had to reply to the toast to the staff, you see. The toast to the staff was delivered by a chap who eventually became a Labour Member of Parliament, Terry McRae was his name.
Oh, yes.
He died recently.
Yeah.
Terry McRae had consumed a good deal of alcohol by the time he was called upon to deliver his toast to the staff. And I had prepared a little speech, a rather dainty speech, about the German sense of humour, you see, in which I made the point that it was wrong to say that Germans had no sense of humour because, after all, the first serious study of the phenomenon of humour was written by Schopenhauer. Anyway, Terry McRae, his speech to the toast to the staff is nothing but a long string of very, very ordinary, very nasty expletives. It was just so insulting, you know. I felt really awful having, it was perfectly obvious that my speech was utterly inappropriate as a response to what had been said. See, but I felt I had no real option. I had to deliver it. And when I was finished, John Bray came over, and tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Horst, I thought it was a splendid job done in extremely difficult, extremely adverse circumstances." Yes, that was rather nice. Mm-hmm.
So, returning again, jumping periods again, Horst, you've met all these people, you've worked with them for nearly a decade, and then you come to a time where you become head of the law school. You said that was a really quite a difficult period to step into that situation.
Yes, it was. Yes.
Not just because of Arthur Rogerson's position, but because of everything that was going on. It's also the time in the early 70s where Dr. Duncan is found dead. Now, was that something that affected you as well?
Yes, I was very much involved in this. I mean, I had been instrumental in having him appointed. It was very common for such positions to be advertised overseas as well, you know. So, and he had responded. He apparently was keen to return to Australia. He was a Melbourne boy who'd contracted tuberculosis at an early age, had a very difficult childhood apparently, and had gone to London. I don't think he studied law in Australia. He went to London and became a bank teller, I think, and was very much taken in hand by two ladies, and a lady and her daughter who took an interest in him. And it looks as though they persuaded him to go to Cambridge and study law, and he did. And he eventually did a PhD in Cambridge and became a lecturer in Bristol. And he accepted our appointment because he wanted to get back to Australia. He had only been here for about 3 weeks when he was drowned in the Torrens, when he was, you know, grabbed by some rather brutish kind of people who threw him into the Torrens, and he couldn't swim. He only had one lung because of tuberculosis, and he wasn't able to swim, so he drowned. It was very dark, although these people, whoever they were, who thrown him in, tried to save him. One of them stripped down to his underpants and jumped in, couldn't find him because it was too dark, you see. And I was very much involved in this because it turned out that so far as anybody could work out, he had no living relatives. He was completely on his own, this man. His sister had predeceased him in New Zealand, his father had died, his mother had died when he was quite young. And he was quite well to do. He'd inherited a lot of BHP shares. Hmm. You know, goodness knows what they'd be worth by now. So he wasn't at all poor. And the public trustee had the problem of knowing what to do with his estate. I think eventually, after quite some time, they found some kind of relative. But because he he had no one able to look after his interests, you know. That when somebody has only just died, you have a sort of feeling that there's still interests to look after.
Yeah.
Because the estate is and so on. I felt that I had to involve myself as head of the department. And when it seemed as though the investigations into the Duncan case were petering out, nobody seemed very interested to work out just who had committed this deed. I wrote to the Attorney General, to the Police Commissioner, and insisted that something more must happen about this. And eventually, a man called Bob Whitington, who was the crime journalist, the Advertiser, took an interest in this. And, the whole thing became a cause célèbre.
Mm.
But it was a fairly stressful business, certainly. I kept being invited to secret meetings of homosexual groups in Adelaide, you know. And I think they regarded me as a bit of a hero because I'd taken up this cause, you see. But I mean, to me, the homosexual aspect was one that wasn't really significant early on. It was just that one of our lecturers had been drowned.
Mm.
And I felt that this needed to be cleared up. But of course, eventually, I think he was regarded by a lot of people as a kind of homosexual martyr.
Hmm. Which would not have even entered your mind in those early days.
Not initially, no. Yeah. But then the coroner made a find. The coroner was a very old man. He was, I think, 90 years old or so. And he made a finding that he had been, based on the forensic examination, the medical examination, that he'd been a passive homosexual. That's how it was put in the report. And Alex Castle, who was the dean at the time, and I was head of the department, he was dean.
Hmm.
We both thought that this was a most unfortunate finding, which was not necessary. And of course, it would have demeaned Duncan in the eyes of a good many people, because there still was, at that time, a tremendous prejudice against homosexuals.
Now, following your headship of the Lord's School, what transpired then in your career, Horst?
Well, I think I was head of the Law Department from 70 to 72, including that 3 years. And then again from 76 to 78. I think that's right. Is that right? Anyway, for 2-3 year periods,
yes.
In the 70s. And during that period, being head of department meant that you had no concessions of any kind. You weren't paid any additional money.
Mm-hmm.
And your teaching obligations remained the same. There was absolutely no let up there. I thought it was really asking rather much of people to be in that position. And I'm fairly conscientious, and I try to do justice to all these aspects of what I was doing. After 78, some of the younger members of staff, some of the more junior members of staff, became willing to take over these positions, and this went on until the early 80s, and I was beginning to feel then that the headship of the department was going to come my way again, probably in the mid-80s. And it was in 84 that the university decided it wanted to reduce the staff, the total university staff, by 25 persons. This is the academic staff. And they made a relatively generous offer. And I thought about this for a while and then decided that it was not made sense for me to accept this offer. And I resigned. At the age of 55, I retired from the university with my superannuation plus a sort of incentive payment.
Mm.
I'd never had much money apart from my salary, and I thought it was rather attractive to become a mini-capitalist. New experiences.
May I just start another session? Excuse me.
Well, if you do, I think I wonder whether we should